This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The majority of North Carolinians graduate from college with student loan debt, and the average borrower in the state owes about $25,000. Fortunately for some, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES, is providing support to those borrowers in the form of temporary forbearance. Between now and September 30th, most federal student loan borrowers will not be penalized for being unable to pay, and no interest will accrue during the forbearance period, which allows many to breathe a sigh of relief. But there are still some who have more questions than answers. WUNC education reporter Liz Schlemmer joins us now to talk about the ins and outs of her reporting on North Carolina student loan debt during COVID-19. Liz, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
Good to have you, and maybe bring some clarity, because I know you've been reporting on student loan debt and how borrowers are handling it during COVID-19. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. I really wanted to look at the news with what the CARES Act brings for student loan borrowers and relief. But of course, that's only for federal student loans. We know many borrowers also have private loans, and there are a lot of special programs that people can sign up for. So the situation really depends on each student or each borrower. And I wanted to look at some of those different pitfalls for students and answer some questions that I was hearing even from some of my own friends.
Well, let's get a snapshot of what it looks like here in North Carolina. I know nationally, the Federal Reserve estimated that student loan debt reached $1.6 trillion, about 45 million borrowers nationwide. What about here in North Carolina?
There are more than 1 million student loan borrowers across North Carolina, and they hold somewhere around $45 billion in debt.
All right. So what about the demographics? Who's doing the borrowing?
We know that student loans are disproportionately taken out by, of course, low-income students and also minority students. So in the UNC system, for example, a recent report found that about 84% of Black students take out loans, compared to less than half of white students. And those loan amounts are also greater that the African-American students are taking out.
And let's talk about, you know, sort of in pre-COVID times, just how student loan debt affects borrowers' daily lives.
Well, we know that the trends are that there are more student loan borrowers than before, and it's also becoming a larger proportion of household debt. And experts say that borrowers are reporting that that's keeping them from making major expenses and reaching life milestones. So things like buying a house or starting a family or even getting married. Some people are delaying this just because of the financial strain that student loans are putting on their savings.
All right, and that was all going on before all of this. So now let's talk about the CARES Act and some of the provisions that it offers and some of the relief that it offers to borrowers. Can you outline that for us?
So this is relief for federal student loans, loans that are held by the U.S. Department of Education, and it creates a forbearance period from March through the end of September in which those borrowers do not have to make payments. There will be no interest accruing on their loans, and there's going to be no debt collection on borrowers who are delinquent for their loans.
All right, but then we know that not all student debt is covered under this forbearance provision, right?
No, I mean, many students also take out private loans, and that is not covered by the CARES Act. You know, this is only for the federal loans coming out of this federal legislation.
Is there anything, so it's not required, but maybe your lender, so possibly if you have a loan from some other source,
yes,
a commercial bank or
something? Yes, I mean, that's a very important point. So, well, it's not mandated by the federal government. Borrowers who hold private student loans may also have some relief, but it's not spelled out in law. Mm. And so in that case, borrowers are going to have to call up their loan servicers and ask what might be available to them. Is there a forbearance period? Is there any forgiveness for missing a loan payment? And also, how do you get out of that forbearance period? All of those things are going to be governed by their own loan providers.
Right. And that can be complicated, I guess, and sometimes intimidating.
Of course. You know, I talked to an expert from the Center for Responsible Lending here in Durham, and she said her number one advice for any student loan borrower is that they should call up their servicer, and they should come armed with questions, pointed questions, to try to find out what kind of loan do they have, what special provisions are there during this time, and how do they navigate them, and what will it mean for the particular kind of loan that they have.
Interesting.
And, you know, it's hard to do. You have to put it on your schedule, and you have to make that call and be prepared to potentially wait on a line, just like you make any other service call.
All right, so that's if you're not covered, what you might do. But again, if you are covered under the CARES Act, this is interesting because there is some kind of thought that you can put into how you want to manage this forbearance time, depending on how flush you are, right? I mean, how you're doing with cash. So give us a sense of how you might manage this forbearance under different financial circumstances personally.
Right. So we know that, of course, there are some borrowers right now who are really struggling, who might be unemployed and might be, you know, trying to make all their bills. And for them, this is relief. It means that they may not have to worry about these payments for a number of months. For others, they may have a new windfall in the form of a stimulus check. And this was the case for a friend of mine who I was talking to, and she was thinking about putting some of her stimulus check towards her federal student loan so that she could pay ahead. Because there's no interest right now, that means you could actually make a greater dent in your principal if you were paying ahead. But there are some caveats to that, too. There are some special programs people may be enrolled in which it wouldn't be to their benefit to pay ahead.
Can you give us a sense of what that might look like, or what I'd have to look out for? What are those programs?
Yes. So this was really what was most surprising to me, is that some people who are in either public service loan forgiveness programs, that they're seeking this loan forgiveness by being employed by a government agency or a nonprofit, schools. I mean, a lot of public school teachers are seeking public service loan forgiveness. For those borrowers, it might not be to their benefit to pay ahead, because if they're still working in public service, these months right now that they are holding that job still count towards their forgiveness. They have to work in this job and make payments for 10 years to have all of their loans forgiven. Well, the time that they're working now is still going to count whether or not they actually make payments during these months. It could be to their benefit to not make those payments and continue to collect the time that they're compiling to get to their forgiveness. And I talked to someone who works at UNC Chapel Hill, and you know, we were chatting about his loan forgiveness, and I said, well, I heard from this expert that, you know, it might not be to your benefit. He was shocked. I mean, you could just kind of hear his jaw drop from the other side of the phone line. And he said, well, I guess I'm going to have to make that call and look into it.
Well, so talk about that. What do we do? Because you've obviously illuminated a number of areas and made things a little more clear. But you know, a lot of these come with, you know, 96-page PDFs to explain who is and who is not eligible. So if you are confused, what would you do?
The top advice is call your loan servicer. You know, ask what kind of loan you have, who owns your loan, what is the relief available to you right now, and is there any negative effect that could come on you if you do make payments, as well as if you don't make payments right now, how are you going to come out of this forbearance period? Is it something where those months that you weren't paying are going to be tacked onto the end of the loan, or is this something where you're going to have to pay out later this year for the months that you weren't paying?
Those are all.
And it's just, you know, it's so specific borrower to borrower that it's really worth making that call.
Now, the student loan forbearance provision under the CARES Act ends on September 30th. What happens after that? Do we know?
Well, that really depends on Congress at this point. You know, the HEROES Act that the House recently passed calls for an extension of that forbearance period until a year from September. However, you know, we know that the Senate is not taking up that piece of legislation, but they will be working on another fourth relief package coming out. You know, the HEROES Act also called for student loan debt cancellation, and that's something that the Democrats in the House wanted, and it's just, you know, it's going to take time. We're going to have to wait and see what the next relief package from Congress looks like and what it includes for student loan borrowers.
And of course, we've been talking about federal legislation. Is there any movement at all, or have you heard any discussion at the state level?
I haven't. I talked to someone from the Center for Responsible Lending about what kinds of things they might be trying for in the state government. And she said that one thing they've been advocating for a while is a Bill of Rights for borrowers, mm-hmm. I believe, that would have specific protections for borrowers and mandate certain transparency. She said that's something they've been advocating for at the state level.
Liz Schlemmer is WUNC's education reporter. Liz, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Today's college graduates carry far more debt than ever before. Nationally, American adults owe $1.6 trillion in student debt. $44 billion of that is owed in North Carolina alone. And it's a burden that leaves many college graduates unable to invest in long-term expenses like mortgage payments or even a car. Now, those are quality of life improvements that are some of the incentives for going to college in the first place. So what's it like to graduate and enter the workforce with tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt? First-generation graduate Trey Roberts is with us. Trey is the community engagement manager for Dix Park Conservancy and co-founder of Raleigh Pride. Trey, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you. You graduated from William Peace University in Raleigh in 2018. Now, that's a private college, which means higher tuition than state colleges. What drew you to that school?
I grew up in a small town of Holliston, North Carolina, and it was it's a very rural area, and I kind of think I wanted to go out and explore and have more opportunities. So I didn't want to get too far from home because growing up in a small community, you kind of cherish that you know everyone, and if you ever need anything, someone can be right around the corner for you. So I didn't want to go too far from home, and I wanted that same experience when I went to school as well. So I wanted to choose a smaller college that would give me more personal connection than maybe a bigger university would have.
Now, did you have any kind of a college fund or savings saved up for this?
No, I didn't. I think when I personally haven't, I think a lot of people in my community don't really go to school. And when they think about promoting education and furthering education, I think money is the last thing on people's mind. And also, I grew up from a mother of a Smart Start teacher, and she really didn't have the ability to put money aside for me for college.
So you did spend your first couple of years at community college, right?
Yeah, I did. I made that choice to hopefully save money when I transitioned into a four-year university.
So now did you think about, I mean, obviously that's one thought about money at that point, you know, go to community college and spend a little bit less. How much did the thought about money and debt and all of that play? How big a part did that play in your decision or even your thought process? I mean, was it sort of 25% of what was weighing down on you as you imagined going to college or what? How did that play a part?
I will say, honestly, the thought about money came and going to college actually came into play my senior year. Now I know most students really think about it early on in their high school, but when I got in my senior year and they really started pressuring us about college choices and FAFSA, which was really foreign to me, that's when it became overwhelming. I actually did get accepted to a school, and the financial aid for it was just so overwhelming, the amount that I just fear to make that step forward, that I even had thoughts of maybe not even expanding my education. And that's what led me to go to community college.
So, first the complexity of it, right? It's like, whoa. Yeah. But to what extent did the thought of having the debt, I mean, I'm wondering if you struggled with the decision to even take out a loan. I mean, apart from the complexity, you know, just the thought that you would come out of school with a big debt.
Yeah. The fear, I'm going to say, growing up and not being able to have some certain luxuries that other people are able to have and growing up not in poverty, you kind of get fearful that your future will lead to you having that limited access to things in the world. I dreamt of something bigger and wanting bigger things, but also dreamt of not being held back by constant debt.
So I know you, go ahead.
You make the choice between taking out these thousands of dollars in loans, and then that fear sometimes just drives you away from, is it worth it? Is it going to just put me back into what I'm trying to escape in the beginning?
And then you talked about being from a small town, not a lot of people. You're the first, I think, in your family to finish college. Is that right?
Yes. My mother did get a two-year associate's degree in the early 90s, but I'm the only one who got a bachelor's degree.
And you also told us how much you love the idea that in a close-knit community like that, everybody supports one another, but not a lot of experience within that community or even in your home in going to a four-year institution or in taking out loans. Could you, you know, was there much experience there? Was there much help, you know, at home or in the community when it came time to take out these loans?
No, it's, I remember being a kid and I remember when someone did go to college. And if that person did eventually graduate college, it was almost like looking at someone with a superpower who understood or had a secret to the world and able to overcome that obstacle to get to that point. So it was, felt like they were – I remember looking at people who did grow up in my town and got a degree and thinking they were something special because they were able to understand or decode something that wasn't given to the rest of us.
Wow. So you have federal and private loans, and I wonder if there's any – any difference now or was at the time in kind of repayment expectations?
Yeah, I will say once I got into repayment and the 6 months ended, I didn't fully understand what that would mean. It terrified me, honestly, that I was a server after I graduated college, that I would not be able to afford to pay the monthly payments and to live on my own. Or to live with a roommate in Raleigh. And I didn't know that you could basically lower your payment based on the amount you made. And even once getting to that moment, that payment amount they wanted me to pay only paid off the interest.
Right.
And then more interest accrued on top of it. So it's almost like I'm in this moment where I'm at income-based repayment, but it feels like purgatory.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting in the middle and just hoping that they won't bother me, that I won't get a phone call, they won't try to take away any money. I just want them to, like, not bother me until maybe some help comes from Washington.
Well, I'm talking to Trey Roberts, a first-generation college graduate, community engagement manager for the Dix Park Conservancy and co-founder of Raleigh Pride, about his experience navigating the student loan process and graduating in 2018. Let's bring another voice into the conversation now. Rochelle Sparco is the director of North Carolina Policy at the Center for Responsible Lending. Rochelle advocates for legislation that would protect student loan borrowers. Rochelle, welcome to State of Things.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here along with Trey. And I wonder if as you listen to Trey's experience and as someone who is looking at the policy questions, if that experience, you know, how broadly that applies to other people around the state.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing from Trey, I guess I was probably and hopefully on mute as I was sort of making sympathetic sighing noise or clucking noises as I listened to his story. You know, his story about being a borrower, student loan borrower from a rural area, first-generation student, it mirrors what we see in the data, you know, that students from rural areas tend to take on debt in higher amounts and higher percentages of students from rural areas take on debt than students who are coming from urban areas. They also tend to have more trouble paying that debt back. And some of that is, you know, that if folks return to their home communities, jobs can be harder to find. Certainly well-paying jobs can be harder to find than in urban communities. And I think you also talked some about that community resiliency and family resiliency is sometimes less in some rural communities than in urban communities where there may be more wealth. We also see very similar stories within communities of color. That there's an enormous wealth gap nationally and in North Carolina. You know, North Carolina ranks 41st in the nation for our racial wealth gap, which is not a place of pride. Where the disparity between the wealth in white households and in households of color is larger than it is in 40 other states. And so there's just less ability within these families and within these communities, potentially to pay for college without taking on debt. And then after graduation to help each other in the event that there is some sort of hiccup, or an enormous pandemic that affects a huge number of people, to weather that storm. And so that drives a lot of the policy work that we're doing at the Center for Responsible Lending around student loan debt.
Yeah, well, when you think about the challenges that presents, I mean, you talk about communities of color for historic reasons and because of discrimination start out with lower wealth on average than white communities. But now at a time when rising student debt, right, when that is greater and greater and greater, and you start out at that disadvantage without the wealth to back you up and to support you if things go wrong, the idea that you can build wealth for that next generation becomes even harder. So, Rochelle, my question for you is for low-income students and students who are Black and brown, are they tending to borrow more now for college? And what does that mean for them coming out?
It does. It does mean that they're borrowing more. The data definitely show that that is what's happening. And we also see then that these borrowers are more likely to be delinquent than their white counterparts. And so right now, of course, that's exacerbated, that there's enormous unemployment and instability in people's income right now. And so we have a great deal of concern both about how much debt people have and also about how payments are made and applied to students' accounts. The prospect that borrowers are going to lose wealth because of this is very real. Before the crisis ever started, one of the largest student loan servicing companies in the United States released some documents as part of a lawsuit with the center with the CFPB up in D.C., and it showed that over the period, I think between 2010 and 2015, that this particular servicer had added $4 billion of student loan debt to students' accounts because of the way in which they were servicing loans. Instead of offering them income-based repayment, like Trey was talking about, it was pushing students into forbearance, which just pushes their payment to zero temporarily and capitalizes interest.
Are you... Yeah, well, let me stop you right there because I want to see how that works, and then we'll talk more about the impact. Is that because they are not properly explaining the options and not properly, Trey talked about the fact that if you got through this process, you had a superpower to get through this, which means some patient explaining. If you're going to say, you've got some forbearance here and not explain that it adds to the interest and adds to the total cost, that student doesn't really know what they should know before they sign that agreement. And is that what's happening in this case, in that particular case, Rochelle?
That is exactly what's happening. So the CEO of that company, which is called Navient, actually was quoted as saying in response to that lawsuit being filed, there is no expectation that the servicer will act in the interest of the consumer, meaning that they're going to do whatever they can to put you into the highest cost option or the fastest option. The reality is that these loan servicers are getting paid very little by the federal government to service these loans. And though we haven't seen much in the way of what's in those contracts, they're not public. We suspect that they're getting, that they're being financially incentivized basically to move callers off the phone as quickly as possible. Putting a borrower into forbearance is a very quick thing to do. Assessing their income and creating an income-based repayment plan for them takes more time. And we believe that they're being pressured to push people off the phone as quickly as possible, borrowers off the phone. And so for both reasons, right, from the perspective of making more money as the servicer and also because their contracts ask them to move quickly through calls, or encourage them to move quickly through calls from borrowers. Both of those things are creating some pressure, and there's no accountability right now. The servicer, in fact, does not owe any duty to the borrowers that are calling. wow. them correct information.
So you can see the situation this puts families, students who are maybe first time in their families, not a lot of experience at home, a lot of intimidation, a lot on their mind, and then the pressure on the part of the lender to get more money from them. That's just quite a storm. Trey, am I right? Did your aunt co-sign for one of these loans for you? Did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah, my private student loan, my aunt had to co-sign in order for me to get it. At the time when I was accepted into William Peace, everything that I was able to get didn't cover living expenses in Raleigh. So I had to stay in the dorm, and it didn't even cover the dorm cost. So I had to go get an extra amount out, which the private student loan has been a little more of an issue for me than the federal one.
Why is that?
Because it's harder to get help on it. Through the bank that I bank with currently, they have no income-based payment plan. And so I kind of just sit there and I have to pay that flat fee every month. Mm-hmm. And even during this pandemic right now, as far as I know, they haven't reached out to me and informed me unless I have to go out and ask them personally. But I know of no help right now during this time.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think too of that conversation you had to have with your aunt and how that felt to you, because that means she had to put her wealth up as collateral, or they wouldn't have taken her as a co-signer. Gets back to what Rochelle says, that wealth is actually being withdrawn from people who are at the lower end of the economic scale in this process, rather than built through the college education. Was it a tough decision for you to ask your aunt to co-sign?
Yeah, it was. It was honestly, I had a lot of guilt about asking her to co-sign. I was honestly, and still right now, I wish there was a way I could get her off of this, like get her away from this, release her from this. But it was very hard to ask her.
But you're making the payments now. And so I want to go back to Rochelle now and talk about, again, the larger implications and what we can do, because we can see in some ways, a college education is working in reverse for students who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum. It's putting them at greater risk rather than giving them more opportunities. Am I overblowing this, Rochelle? It's starting to swell
exactly
in my mind
right
here. Yeah.
Yeah.
What can we do? I mean, what are there other options? Are there better protections? How would you shift this picture?
There are two things that I think could help here right now. One of them, right, we were talking a minute ago about servicers and how they don't have an obligation to tell borrowers the best strategy for those individuals. There are a number of states, not including North Carolina, who've passed student borrower bills of rights. And these take many kinds of forms, but generally speaking, what they do is they create that obligation that servicers give borrowers the best possible information for their particular situation, and also create a way to enforce that, building in some accountability, right? So in some states, there's a special student loan ombudsperson who can take complaints from borrowers and investigate those. In other states, that power is vested in the attorney general's office. And here we do actually have a position in the attorney general's office right now, a gentleman who does work with student loan borrower issues, but doesn't have a particular title there. But the AG's office here does have a helpful website for students who are looking for more information about the protections that are available for them right now because of the COVID-19 crisis.
Is there much? Go ahead. Finish that thought, please.
I was just going to say, you know, we do have the authority to create those kinds of protections for North Carolina borrowers the same way that many other states have. And perhaps this crisis gives us the sort of impetus to take a look at that and do something about it.
Trey, right now, what would it take for you to be able to pay off your student loans in full?
To be frank, some sort of forgiveness.
Yeah.
To be honest. At least in my perspective right now, unless I get really lucky and I move up the ranks and I make some money, and even by that time I'm new to my career field, even during that time, who knows what it'll look like. Yeah. But yeah,
I would say some forgiveness.
I'm talking to Trey Roberts, Community Engagement Manager for the Dix Park Conservancy, co-founder of Raleigh Pride. Trey, thank you so much and good luck with it all.
All right, thank you.
And Rochelle Sparco, Director of North Carolina Policy at the Center for Responsible Lending. Rochelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about what they're doing at the Center for Responsible Lending and all that we've talked about today regarding student debt at our website, stateofthings.org.